hearing on the Internal Revenue Service's fiscal year 2013 budget request in the 2012 tax filing season. Hardworking American taxpayers have faced incredible challenges over the last several years. Many have struggled with unemployment, sluggish economic growth, and doubt about our country's economic future because of out-of-control spending and looming public debt. And then tax season comes around. The tax code, which has tripled in size since 1975, continues to burden American families and small businesses with too many taxes, too many loopholes, and too many pages. It's estimated that the average taxpayer spends 21 hours and over $250 complying with the tax code each year. They must keep track with an increasingly complex and difficult to understand tax code, or at least hire someone else who does. The Internal Revenue Service, of course, has the unenviable job of administering and enforcing our convoluted tax code. As we meet today, we are in the middle of the 2012 tax return filing season, and millions of taxpayers and employers are willing to meet their tax filing obligations. Some have reported experiencing delays in receiving tax refunds, and programming errors at IRS have delayed some 6 million returns, which we will discuss at today's hearing. We will also talk about the frustrating issue of tax fraud and improper payments. Taxpayers are exasperated because while they work so hard to comply with tax code, they see press reports of thieves robbing the Treasury of billions of dollars each year. One recent press report detailed how an identity theft ring in Florida committed $130 million in fraud through stolen Social Security numbers. On top of this fraud, tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money is lost every year through improper payments of refundable tax credits, including $17 billion a year for the earned income tax credit alone. Finally, we'll talk about the administration's fiscal year 2013 budget request for the IRS. For fiscal year 2013, the administration has requested nearly $13 billion in appropriations for the agency, an increase of 8% from fiscal year 2012. Included in this request are over $360 million and nearly 900 new employees to implement portions of the Affordable Care Act, including the new insurance subsidy and the controversial individual mandate penalty. We look forward to discussing this and the other new initiatives that the IRS plans for fiscal year 2013. With that, I would like to welcome Commissioner Douglas Shulman here today, and I look forward to a fruitful discussion of his agency, his mission, and the ongoing tax return filing season. Before I yield to the ranking member, Mr. Lewis, I ask unanimous consent from all members written statements be included in the record. Without objection, so ordered. I will also ask unanimous consent that GAO's report on the 2011 tax filing season and fiscal year 2012 budget request be included in the record. Without objection, so ordered. Mr. Lewis.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for holding this hearing on the Internal Revenue Service. I'm pleased that we have the commissioner before us today. I have serious concern about the effect of recent budget cuts on taxpayers, tax collection, and agency operation. In her most recent report to Congress, the National Taxpayer Advocate stated that the most serious problem facing taxpayers is that the IRS is not adequately funded to serve taxpayers and collect taxes. I fully agree with her statement. This year, the agency budget was cut by over $300 million. This cut harmed taxpayers and telephone service. Telephone calls have increased by 34%, but the hours phones are answered have decreased by 20%. Over 65% of taxpayers seeking telephone assistance are able to speak to an IRS employee, and they must wait an average of 17 minutes. Taxpayers seeking in-person assistance also have been harmed. This is clear from the very long wait time at taxpayers' assistance centers. The budget cut also harmed agency operation. The cut forced the agency to lay off thousands of employees. The majority of these employees work in enforcement. They protect and collect revenue. This reduction does not help tax collection or reduce the deficit. It makes no sense. I look forward to discussing these issues in the agency proposed budget for next year. Madam Chair, finally, I would like to take a moment to thank Floyd Williams for his service and dedication to the agency and to this Congress. As many of you know, Floyd is the Legislative Affairs Director for the IRS, and he planned to retire this summer. Floyd began his government service as a congressional page under Senator Fulbright of Arkansas many years ago. Floyd, I think the senator from Arkansas probably violated the child labor law. You're not that old. I have worked with Floyd in many roles on this committee, and I know that he will be missed. I wish him the best as he retires. Thank you for your great service. And with that, Madam Chair, I yield back.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. I would like to welcome back the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, Mr. Douglas H. Shulman, who has served as Commissioner since March 2008. Commissioner Shulman, thank you again for your time today. The committee has received your written statement, and it will be made part of the formal hearing record. You will be recognized for 5 minutes for your oral remarks, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much to all the members of the subcommittee for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I want to talk about a little about filing season, our strategic initiatives, and the President's 2013 budget, which would give us a much-needed increase over the 2012 enacted levels. A significant portion of the President's 2013 budget would restore congressional reductions in IRS funding made over the last 2 years. I want to start by saying that I believe it's incumbent on all of us in the government to be as efficient as possible and to spend taxpayer dollars wisely. For the IRS, that means finding savings where we can and continuing to invest in strategic priorities that allow us to improve service and voluntary compliance. From fiscal year 2009 through the 2013 proposed budget, we will have achieved nearly $1 billion in budget savings and efficiencies in core IRS operations. These savings and efficiencies reflect an across-the-board commitment at the IRS to find better and more efficient ways to administer the tax system. At the same time, we collect $200 in revenue for every dollar spent on our budget. We also collect $2.4 trillion last year. We issued 110 million refunds for $345 billion to hardworking American taxpayers. Our compliance activities brought in a direct revenue of $55 billion, and we blocked another $14 billion from going out the door to taxpayers who are trying to commit fraud on the government. In this regard, I want to point out that the administration's proposal for IRS funding includes critically important enforcement initiatives that would be funded through a program integrity cap adjustment. Let me just say that this proposal makes sense and is a reflection of the President and this administration's belief that IRS funding actually helps reduce the deficit. Congress is literally leaving money on the table if it does not enact this proposal, which would allow for deficit-reducing initiatives in tax compliance while leaving specific funding decisions to the normal annual appropriations process. Let me just talk about a couple of things that we've done over the last few years that have moved the agency forward to position it for the future and do a better job serving taxpayers and making sure they comply with the tax code. Let me just start with filing season. E-file continues to grow. This year, we've issued about 59 million refunds for a total of $174 billion. That's about the same number as last year. And we deployed several new large technology systems, and I'm going to be happy to talk about those as we get further into filing season. In strategic areas, this year, for the first time in history, we've moved from a weekly batch cycle to daily processing of tax returns through CADE 2. CADE 2 delivers on the promise of IRS modernization going back two decades, and we're very proud of this achievement. A couple of years ago, I told this committee we restructured our technology program. We were going to deliver our major technology initiatives, and this year we have delivered those initiatives. We also had the highest score ever last year on the American Customer Satisfaction Index rating, which is the overall score we track for taxpayers' satisfaction with their interactions with the IRS. We scored 73 on this index, and we're very proud of this achievement in constrained budget environments. Our Return Preparer program is now up and running. To date, more than 840,000 paid preparers have registered with the IRS, and both the testing and education requirements are well underway. This is going to be one of the most important initiatives in the tax system in several decades. We've also made significant progress in our battle against offshore tax evasion. We've collected more than $4.4 billion to date through our offshore voluntary disclosure program. We're getting people back in the system through this and other offshore initiatives. And I think we've made significant progress. As I said, we've cut $1 billion out of our core operating budget through the 2013 budget statement or budget proposal that we've given. Let me conclude my opening statement with one concern that I want to emphasize for this subcommittee, and I think it's quite important for the Ways and Means Committee as a whole. In recent years, it seems taxpayers increasingly face uncertainty about what the tax law will be for the next filing season. This year, we at the IRS are very concerned with the status of the AMT and so-called extenders. If the AMT and extenders are not dealt with in a timely fashion, we may have to delay the start of filing season for many millions of taxpayers, as we have done in prior years. And I've written to this committee before that it is imperative that whatever action Congress decides to take on AMT and extenders, that this action happen by the end of the year, which would still be late from an operational perspective, but not longer than that, in order to prevent even more widespread disruption of next year's tax filing season.
Thank you, Commissioner Shulman. I think we will turn to questioning now. We will alternate between sides with 5 minutes being given to every member. Last year, you testified to the committee that enforcement and customer service are not an either-or proposition. Providing quality taxpayer service, especially during the filing season, is important to help taxpayers avoid unintentional errors, inadvertent noncompliance, and reduce other burdensome post-filing interactions with the IRS. So far this filing season, access to live IRS assisters is down to 65%, and taxpayers are waiting an average of 18 minutes to talk with an IRS assister. The rate of taxpayers getting busy signals that are disconnected from the IRS have roughly doubled. Yet this is not a new problem, but rather seems to be just a bad trend. Since 2004, the percentage of answered calls has dropped from 87% to 70% in 2011. Last year, the average wait time was 12 minutes. In 2007, it was 5 minutes or less. Personally, I have heard from Kansas CPAs that it's not uncommon to be on hold for 30 minutes. According to GAO, this decline in customer service has occurred despite the number of full-time equivalents dedicated to answering the phones having increased from 8,000 in fiscal year 2007 to 8,800 in 2011. And despite greater use of automated answers and self-service website options, it seems to me that the IRS has placed greater emphasis on enforcement at the expense of service. Yet, as you told us last year, the lack of service for those who have questions will only lead to greater noncompliance than if those questions had been answered. So can you help me better understand a few things? First, what actions are being taken to ensure that taxpayers are able to reach a live IRS assister? Secondly, given your belief that the IRS must deliver both enforcement and customer service, do you think that this budget request focuses too much on enforcement while sacrificing customer service? And then finally, does the IRS consider this to be an acceptable level of service?
No, thanks for bringing up, a set of important issues. First, let me repeat what I told you last year and what I talk about a lot with our employees and members of Congress and everyone involved in the tax system, which is it is not an either-or proposition. We need to run service operations and compliance operations to make the nation's tax system work. Let me put in context the resources that we have this year to put towards both enforcement and customer service. We had a $300 million budget cut, which was $1.2 billion less than the president had requested for service and enforcement last year. We also had to absorb for rent and other kinds of increase about $200 million of inflation. And $66 million was put into our technology accounts, which we're very appreciative of. So if you take 300, 200, 66, we had a $566 million reduction in our core services and enforcement accounts. And what we're trying to do is do the best we can with the resources we were given. Last year, our phone level of service was about 70%. This year, it's running at about 66%, even though we had predicted about 61%. And the reason for that is we've really squeezed efficiency. We've routed calls. More people are using automated answering systems, and people are using our website. As you said, the wait is longer, because at a certain point, we can squeeze as many efficiencies out of technology and other efficiencies as we can, but it comes to how many people do we have answering phones. Volume is up, so the numbers you gave that said we have more people, we also have much more volume, we have more taxpayers, we have a more complicated tax code right now. Another number that's interesting to look at is how many people hang up in the first couple of minutes, because we've added a feature that tells them how long it'll wait. And we say, if you want to either use the web, use our automated phone, or call back when there's less time, then our phone level of service this year is 77%, if you look at how many, if you take away the people who hung up in the first couple of minutes. And so I guess my view of this is we've taken a whole bunch of actions. At a certain point, we need money to invest, because you need people to answer phones for live service. That I'm pretty proud that while service is down, it hasn't degraded, to a point where it could have gone given the cuts. And the answer to your last question, which is, do we think it's acceptable? I want everyone who contacts the IRS to get what they need from the IRS. This year, everyone's not getting what they need from the IRS, but I think we're doing a pretty good job given the resources we were given.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. I'm just looking at data, and the budget cuts compared to the level of service aren't always, they don't always follow given this information from the GAO. So we just encourage you to continue to work on that, and we'd be delighted to work with you any way we can. And with that, I would recognize Mr. Lewis for 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Commissioner, the GAO notes that there have been a 34% increase in the number of calls this filing season and about a 50% increase and calls answered by the automated form service. Could you tell us what are the taxpayers calling about? What are the nature of the calls?
You know, calls can be anything from people want to set up a payment plan to people are curious, you know, I'm filling out my return and I'm going to take this deduction. How does that work? Just general tax law questions. Two questions about where's my refund? I filed last Friday, and my preparer told me I would get a refund on Wednesday, and I haven't gotten it. And so, you know, calls vary. So we can get you a specific breakdown of what the calls are.
Well, thank you very much. We understand IRS is requesting a cap adjustment of about $700 million for next year's budget to fund enforcement program. What are your plans, if any, if the agency does not receive these resources?
Well, we're still early in the congressional budget and appropriations cycle, and so, you know, we're quite hopeful. And in the past, we've had broad bipartisan support for cap adjustments. The most recent cap adjustment was 2006 and 2007 with a Republican president and a Democratic-controlled Congress. And so we actually think that this is a bipartisan proposal. It reflects the administration's belief that prudent investments in the IRS are good for deficit reduction, and so that there should be cap adjustments for our budget, and that investments for us is good for the long term for the tax system. And so, you know, right now, I think our position is that this budget program integrity cap adjustments are good for the system, that people should agree with it, and we've had good, productive conversations in both the House and the Senate about it.
Mr. Commissioner, could you tell members of the subcommittee how has the $300 million budget cut impacted taxpayer service this year, and what taxpayer service have been reduced?
Yeah, so, you know, for Ms. Jenkins, I walked through the notion of there's $300 million at the top, but there's the impact is greater given where the resources were put in our budget. You know, I think we have a slight dip in number of taxpayers served in walk-in centers, but we've had a corresponding increase in number of taxpayers served in volunteer VITA sites where we encourage them to go because we work in partnership with community organizations. Our phone level of service is down by about 4% compared to last year, although automated calls are up. And the wait times are longer. And so there's been, I guess the way I characterize it is there's been a predictable effect because of less resources. With that said, I'm quite proud that we've been able to mitigate some of that effect by making sure we work smart and we really drive efficiencies as hard as we can.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner. And I yield back, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And now we will give 5 minutes to the representative from Minnesota, Mr. Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today, actually. I just wanted to follow up on a letter I sent to you not too long ago. In the last year, you've been talking a lot or a great deal about this concept of a real-time tax system, and have had a number of actually public meetings on the issue as well. And I know that there are benefits to receiving real-time verification and having that information up hand, but I am concerned that the costs could outweigh the benefits, particularly in the sense that having this filing system could lead to a burden that is very similar to the 1099 provision that was being rolled out as a part of the President's new health care law, which would have been a nightmare for America's employers, small and large. And so, you know, if the IRS is going to make this real-time system work, I'm sure you're going to want to have all the data earlier than is required today. You're probably going to want more 1099 data as well. Just looking at what's been discussed today, it seems that compressing this reporting timeline is going to make it more challenging for reporting requirements for pretty much a very onerous and burdensome process right now. So let me ask you this. What are you doing right now to work with existing stakeholders, with the business community kind of, you know, to kind of get their feedback, their buy-in as a part of this? Because there's no doubt that increased regulatory and compliance costs are a big deal now for employers. It's one of the reasons why I think that level of uncertainty, you mentioned some tax rate issues and AMT and extenders issues, but I know this is a factor as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? Have you conducted any studies of the increased cost to businesses of changing deadlines, for instance, for reporting informational returns or increasing reporting requirements? Or would you agree to an independent study as a part of that process? Would that make sense?
Yeah, no, thanks, Mr. Paulson. Great questions and important set of issues. So let me give you this perspective on it. I view one of my jobs as commissioner to make sure I'm helping prod the tax system forward so it works better for the American people 10 years and 20 years from now than it does today. And the combination of consumer expectations of us working better and quicker and more timely with taxpayers, with the advances in technology, clearly there's room for us to think about a future that works better for people. And what really struck me is the average taxpayer, if they have an interaction with us beyond just filing, that interaction is they have their economic activity 1 year, they file their return the next year, and it can take us a year to 2 years to reach out to them. And so by the time we go back to them, they've either spent their refund or they've, their records and all the memory is gone, whether it's a small business or an individual. And I think the current system actually adds a lot of burden to people, and we've heard that. And so I laid out this vision that said, what if we could clear everything up rather than coming back to them on the back end at the time they filed, which is the simplest way to think about this. But I also recognized all the things you said, which is this is something that would affect all of the stakeholders in the tax system, from taxpayers to tax preparers to information return filers. And so the way we went about this is the way I think that a public agency should go about this, which is we held a series of public meetings, which I hosted, with stakeholders, the broad range of stakeholders, to get their input. And what we heard universally is basically makes sense. We'd all love to have everything work faster in the tax system, but we need to make sure we work through the details together in a constructive fashion so that we don't add burden in the process. And so what we're doing now is taking the next step and really developing detailed vision about what this would mean. And I think there's been some misunderstanding. So we've never suggested speeding up or adding more information reporting. We've asked questions about what do people have now, when is it ready, and when could they get it to us? Not is there more, or would they have to start doing what they already do faster? And we've asked ourselves internally, how do our systems work? And when could we do this kind of matching?
So let me just ask you this before time is kind of running out here. How much will an upgraded system cost? I mean, to sort of encapsulate all of this and that would be needed to run this type of system. How many years would it take to build and test? Because, I mean, you're here justifying the budget in terms of the requests that Congress would give to the president, for instance, or the administration to run your operations.
Yeah, way too early. This is a vision that we're having conversations with stakeholders. The first step is laying out exactly what it would mean. There's a bunch of things we can do right away, which is just process things through our system quicker so we could have quicker engagement. And so, I can't tell you, there's no blueprint right now. We've laid out a vision. We've had a broad set of stakeholder engagement, and we're now moving in to have the next round of stakeholder engagement.
Would it be safe to say that you plan to have an actual proposal for Congress to have feedback on at some point as a part of your vision?
I think, for sure, we will have public proposals, so we'll have plenty of time for interaction.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will recognize Representative Becerra for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, always good to see you. By the way, thank you for the work that you're doing, given the real budgetary constraints that you're facing. And if you'll pass along to each and every one of your employees who are doing yeoman's work, I can't imagine the stress that they're under, given that you've got thousands of Americans waiting to connect with them on the phone, who are waiting 10, 20 minutes, and many of them very unhappy that they have to wait that long. I think after 2 or 3 minutes, most Americans tend to hang up on any any phone call where they're having to be put on hold. So I hope we'll get this done in a smart way. And I don't believe that the first thing we want to do is shortchange the agency, which already has a tough task, and that's asking Americans to voluntarily pay their taxes. And when we have responsible Americans who do so, to watch as others don't, it's very frustrating. And we don't want to undermine the voluntary compliance rates that we have in this country by Americans who pay their taxes. So please share with all the folks that you work with that we thank them very much. And also tell that gentleman right over there, Mr. Williams, that we thank Floyd Williams for all his years of service. We're going to miss him because he has been a tremendous asset to not just the Congress, to the American people, because of the service he's provided to the IRS and to us as the go-between your agency and the Congress. We're going to miss him, and we want to say, Floyd, to you, thank you for all the service that you've provided over the years. One more thanks. Your initiative on tax preparers, that universe of people out there who were representing themselves as competent, qualified to prepare Americans' tax returns and get paid to do it. And we know that there's some great ones, but we know that there have been some that have just ripped off the American public. It's hard to believe that you need a license to cut someone's hair, but in America, you don't need a license to prepare someone's perhaps most important tax or financial document. So I thank you for the initiative to try to bird dog that industry and make sure competent folks are the ones that are preparing our taxes. I am distressed. As I sit and listen to what you're saying, you've lost 5,000 employees. Your budget was cut $300 million. We know that when you do tax compliance enforcement, that dollar you spend to have that investigator and those folks who follow through to make sure people are complying with the payment of the taxes they owe, that you return $6 for every dollar we invest in you to do that. And for us to be cutting $300 million from your budget, it's distressing, because the last thing we want is the stories of how some overzealous tax agent goes and busts someone's door down to try to collect taxes. The truth is, for the most part, you have employees who do just yeoman's work to try to help their fellow Americans prepare their taxes. So I hope that you will sound the alarms, if they are alarms, on the ability for us to pay our taxes the right way voluntarily. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we now estimate that some $385 billion annually is not paid in taxes that are either avoided or intentionally not paid in this country. Is that $385 billion, is that the estimate now?
That's the tax gap estimate for tax year 2006.
Yeah, and so that's more money. That's more money than we would fund you for how many years?
A lot.
It's just incredible. We have Americans who are voluntarily paying their taxes. You got a whole bunch of other Americans who unfortunately aren't doing what they should or at the level they should. And so the responsible taxpayers in this country are having to cover for those who aren't. And you can go out and figure out who they are if you just had the compliance money, the enforcement money, to go out there and find them. Many of them make errors, simple errors. And I think most of those Americans are ready to pay their fair share. Others aren't. Others are trying to send their money overseas and do things that they shouldn't. And we should make them pay their fair share. And I just hope that we go out there and do this the right way. Is there any hope that with the funding that you're getting that you can fulfill everything that we're asking you to do?
Well, look, one is it's very much the prerogative of Congress to fund us, and whatever Congress ends up giving us, we'll do the best that we can. I'm quite proud of this agency delivering on multiple fronts over the last several years, and especially this year in a decreased budget environment, and truly trying to balance compliance and service, and I think we're doing a good job.
Thank you. The time has expired. Ms. Black is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shulman, for being here. We're all talking about limited dollars, and we need to spend our dollars in the best way we possibly can. I was reading a report just recently from the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, who found billions of dollars in federal education credits that were issued in error. And what I'm really trying to get to here is, number one, to save. So make sure we're giving the money to the people that really deserve the money so that we can use it in the budgetary process to fund those places, such as yourself, that can continue to do a good job. But it's very disturbing when I see here how much money this represents that was potentially given to those who don't deserve it. And I just want to read a couple of things out of that report. 1.7 million, million taxpayers received $2.6 billion in education credits for students for whom there was no supporting documentation in the IRS files that they even attended an educational institution. Almost 380,000 of these individuals claimed as students were not eligible because they did not attend the required amount of time or were postgraduate students, resulting in an estimated $550 million in erroneous education credits. 64,000 of those taxpayers erroneously received $88 million in education credits for students claimed as a dependent or a spouse on the other one's return, so it was a double payment. 250 prisoners erroneously received over $255,000. And then it says here that it was identified that a valid Social Security number is required for federal student aid, but not for these educational credits. Now, that just blows me away. I know when we were talking about the child tax credit at one of the other hearings, that was told to us that there wasn't a requirement that they have a Social Security number. So I'm not sure how you track that when you don't have a Social Security number being used. But I want to go to trying to find ways to help you, what we can do, what kind of tools we can do and give you so that you can have the authority to say, we're not going to process this return. It doesn't have the proper information on there. And Social Security number just seems like an easy thing for me. Not sending it to a prison would seem like an easy thing, as well as making sure that they attended the classes or at least attended a college and perhaps maybe a valid school EIN number would also help to make sure that when those credits are being processed that you have all the information to verify that truly they qualify for those. So can you help me out with that?
Sure. No, thanks for bringing it up, and I appreciate the offer of help. We can use always use help. The a couple of things. One is we've significantly stepped up our effort to crack down on fraud. Last year we stopped $14 billion in potentially either fraudulent or mistaken credits from going out the door. The specific report that you referenced, I just want to point out a couple of things. There was an Inspector General report a couple of years earlier that showed that there was huge error rate on the 1099 or 1098s, which are the education reports we get. And so while they said that report said that there could have been that level of fraud, there's also a recognition that the documents they were using to match might not have been accurate documents, meaning the education institutions often don't send in the right information, so it's not always clear that the student wasn't there, even though that it came up. With that said, the answer to what we can get to help, if we want to block a credit because we think there's not right documentation, if we don't have math error authority, we have to go through a full-fledged audit, which is resource intensive, and it comes to people because we won't open. You know, even if we see an issue, if we don't have people who will follow up, answer the phone, engage with the taxpayer, we can't block it because we can't change their return. If we have math error authority tied to certain provisions, then we can block it and change the return without going through a full-fledged audit. And so we've requested in this budget math error authority for a couple of things. The second is, you mentioned prisoners, authorization for us to share information with prisons so there can be a real punishment for a prisoner, like losing privileges or put in solitary confinement if they try to defraud the system. Our authorization in Congress to actually share information back with prisons so we can have that kind of dialogue expired at the end of last year. So re-upping that authorization is another thing that you all could do to help.
So this math error authority, you need to be given that. Is that by law?
Yes.
So we do have to change the law. And do you all already have the authority to require that there be a Social Security number on that form? Do you
so have that's, that? That's a whole different issue because certain tax credits, you have to have a certain Social Security number. Certain tax credits, you don't. The ones you're mentioning, you don't. And so it's not a requirement. And
well,
so people bring it up. So if Congress decides that only people with Social Security numbers can get that credit, then that would have to be up to Congress. We can't stop it because it's not a requirement at this point.
Okay. I know of some ways we can help you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Commissioner Shulman, good to see you. I apologize for arriving very late to this hearing. And before I recognize Mr. Reed for his questions. No, I'm going to recognize you. But I also want to take a moment to recognize Floyd Williams for his 15 years of service at the IRS. And I think it's a total of, 35 years of government service? Sir, we want to thank you as you move on to what I hope is a good retirement. Thank you for your service. And with that, Mr. Reed, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here with us today. Commissioner, I'd like to explore, I really try to rely on data and when we make decisions here in Congress. And one thing that I have a concern with is on the enforcement initiatives, you have certain projections on the return of investment for those enforcement initiatives. I'm sure you're familiar with the issue that we're going to talk about here. I believe 2013, you proposed enforcement initiative, our return on investment will be 1.9 to 1. 2015, you project, it's my understanding, the return on the investment for those enforcement initiatives will be 4.321. Historically, I read some reports that projected that by 2012, it was supposed to be a 7.8 return on investment to a dollar. So do you confirm those numbers, those estimates, those projections with actual data? And if you do, how do you do that? If you don't, why don't you do that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Let me give you how I think about return on investment and exactly what backs it up. First of all, we're very conservative in the numbers we give you. Those are the people that we know do those jobs, a rolling 10-year average on the exact enforcement initiative. So if we're going to hire, 20 grade 13 examiners for an excise tax, we look at 10-year rolling average about how much revenue comes in directly from those people making adjustments that actually comes into the Treasury. So it's a look back 10-year rolling average are those numbers. I actually think those way understate the impact, because the real game of running the tax system and the real objective is the $2.4 trillion that comes in every year, which most of those people we don't engage with in that kind of activity. And so our job is to run good service, so when people call, they can answer our questions, compliance coverage where there's the most risk, so that if you get an audit, your neighbors know that you get an audit around specific issues, and it drives voluntary compliance. So another way to look at our numbers is $12 billion budget, give or take, $2.4 trillion in revenue. Every dollar invested brings you 200. Or a smaller way to look at it is we have what we call our Turk numbers, which are real dollars in the door every year. Last year it was about $55 billion. The year before it was $57. The year before it was $49. And that's literally, people go out, make an adjustment, people go through the adjudicatory process and bring money into us. So you could also, that's a 5-to-1 return. So, but the numbers you gave us are based on very specific activities in a granular way based on the kind of people who do those activities. Looking back 10 years, how does that tie to those Turk numbers?
So is it fair to say then your testimony to us would be that they're based on actual data when you go back and confirm the numbers? I mean, are you looking at actual data? When you project the 1.9 to 1 for 2013 return on investment, you will be able to show us at the end of 2013 the actual data that confirmed whether or not you hit 1.9 to 1 return on investment.
I think we'll be able to you know, what I said was, I think it's very good numbers. It's 10-year rolling averages. I think things spike and they move, so this is an estimate. So 2013 might not be exactly that. It might be higher in 2013 or lower, but over a 10-year period, I think you're going to see it average out to be that amount.
Because I guess that's my question, because in 2012, it was projected to be a 7.8 to 1 return on investment. Was it 7.8, or what was the number for 2012 on your enforcement initiative return on investment?
Again, I don't think you want to look at these things as, you know, year, point in time, and you don't want to encourage us to do that. What you want to encourage us is to get the right resources that over time are going to drive the right taxpayer behavior. These numbers are ones we certainly consult with GAO, OMB on. I think we're very comfortable with these numbers, and we have ongoing dialogues with them.
And you bring up a great point when you bring GAO into the conversation, because my understanding, reading some of their materials, that they're very concerned that you're not using actual data to confirm those projected return on investment numbers that you're given to us.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it as very concerned. I think they've said we can together work on methodology, and we're actually having those staff conversations on a regular basis.
Okay. So you're working with GAO to come to some sort of...
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I feel very comfortable in our numbers, and if anything, I think they understate the return.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate the work you do, Commissioner. I really do. I really do, and I appreciate all the work you do over there, because it's a tough job.
Yeah, no. Thank and these are great questions, because we need to be accountable for delivering results. So
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you. With that, Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you. Commissioner Shulman, again, welcome. And does the IRS have available resources with the current budget to tackle new enforcement responsibilities? New enforcement responsibilities. Do you have the resources available to take on new enforcement responsibilities?
Earlier I was saying, you know, we try to do the best we can with the budget that Congress gives us. Obviously, we have a big job to do, and we try to balance across the board all of the things that we do. We've requested in the 2013 budget some new resources for some of the new legislation that's come through, and we're quite hopeful that we'll get that.
Because in reviewing the President's 2013 budget proposal, this proposes saddling the IRS with additional enforcement responsibilities by shifting alcohol, tobacco tax, and Trade Bureau duties of enforcing tax provisions related to alcohol and tobacco to the IRS with no funding allocated in this budget to pursue those kinds of violations. Is that something that you've had internal discussions with others in the administration about?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, what are you referring to in the budget?
Yeah.
I don't think there's a major shift in the budget.
Well, I think the 2013 budget proposes giving you additional enforcement responsibilities by shifting alcohol and tobacco tax and Trade Bureau duties to the IRS.
I should get back to you on this, because
okay.
I don't
okay.
think there's a whole shift proposed. In the past, we've been reimbursed to have some of our criminal investigators help them with some investigations, and that's what I'm aware of happened
okay.
in the past.
Yeah, if you could just get me some clarification on that, I would appreciate it.
Sure.
And one other question. It's come to my attention. I've gotten a number of letters just recently. We've seen some recent press allegations that the IRS is targeting certain Tea Party groups across the country, requesting what have been described as onerous document requests, delaying approval for tax-exempt status and that kind of thing. Can you elaborate on what's going on with that? I mean, can you give us assurances that the IRS is not targeting particular groups based on political leanings?
Yeah. No, thanks for bringing this up, because I think there's been a lot of press about this and a lot of moving information, so I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. First, let me start by saying, yes, I can give you assurances. As you know, we pride ourselves on being a non-political, nonpartisan organization. I'm the only me and our chief counsel are the only presidential appointees, and I have a 5-year term that goes beyond, runs through presidential elections, just so we will have none of that kind of political, intervention in things that we do. for 501c4 organizations, which is what's been in the press, organizations do not need to apply for tax exemption. Organizations can actually hold themselves out as 501c4 organizations and then file a 990 with us. The organizations that have been in the press are all ones that are in the application process. So first of all, I think it's very important to emphasize that all of these organizations came in voluntarily. They did not need to engage the IRS in a back and forth. They could have held themselves out, filed a 990, and if we would have seen an issue, we would have engaged, but otherwise we wouldn't. The basic rules around 501c4 organizations are that they need to be primarily engaged in promoting the common good and general welfare of their community. They can be involved in political and campaign activity, but it can't be their primary purpose. When people apply for 501c4 status, what we do is engage them in a number of questions about making sure that we understand their primary purpose around this and other sorts of engagement. And so what's been happening has been the normal back and forth that happens with the IRS. None of the alleged taxpayers, and obviously I can't talk about individual taxpayers and I'm not involved in these, are in an examination process. They're in an application process, which they moved into voluntarily. And so there's absolutely no targeting. This is the kind of back and forth that happens when people apply for 501c4 status.
And finally, is it fair to say that there's been no change in IRS practice with regard to what triggers audits and so forth with regard to tax-exempt organizations as a whole?
So as a whole, we have audits based on risk criteria, coverage requirements, et cetera. But in the area of political activities, just to make extra sure that folks are very insulated, we actually have a committee of three career professionals who aren't based in Washington, D.C., that any time an audit will be triggered because of potential political activity, or if there's a referral from a member of Congress and other kinds of things that could be viewed as political, that group of three actually first looks at it. So no single individual can launch an audit, that there's, you know, it has to be agreement amongst three. Then the decision would be made for an audit based on resources, risk, allegations, facts, et cetera, and it would be shipped out to an auditor to do that audit. That's been the practice for many years for anything to do with political activity, and that's the practice now.
I thank you for your answer. Dr. McDermott, do you want to inquire? You may inquire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to shift the question just a little bit, or the issues that you've been dealing with here. I have a lot of LGBT clients or constituents, and they have been approaching me about the problems of dealing with the IRS and how to file their income taxes, and are having the experience of having more than one source give them a different answer. So they're not quite sure, and they're spending some of them twice as much as a married couple would spend to get their income tax done. They've gotten married under the law, but suddenly the IRS has got thing that when they ask questions about certain things, it's just not clear what the answer is. So I'm wondering, is there any single place, or perhaps should there be a single place, where they can call and find out the answer to a question, or some place in the IRS where somebody takes this issue and begins to give definitive answers?
Yeah, so great question. I'm aware of the issue, and we've actually tried to do a bunch. First of all, this is a very complex issue for these taxpayers because under state law, these taxpayers have a different legal status than under federal law because of some of our federal laws. So under state law, they often split the income, but under federal law, they have to actually file separately because of the federal laws. We recognize that there was a lot of confusion, and so we actually consolidated and put a group together who worked and put out a whole set of frequently asked questions that answered a lot of these questions. And so we realize that as laws have changed around the country, this has been an issue. We've been engaging with the community around this, and I think we've clarified a lot of questions. Let me just say, though, until you have state laws and federal laws recognizing couples the same way, this is going to remain difficult for people, because some of the things people have asked us to do, we can't do under the law.
Is there, when they're filing their income tax federally, do they, I suppose if they've, if you have different thing at the state level, but federally, if they are doing it together, they can't do it together. Is that what you're saying?
It all depends. You know, different states have different domestic partnership laws. But, you know, there's state returns often piggyback on federal returns, but recognizing couples as couples is different depending on whether you're in the state or, you know, depending which state, and also federal laws are different.
So that the piggybacking off the federal tax return sort of works in reverse at the at state level. They're going to have to change some state laws to actually make this rational.
It adds complexity to these taxpayers filing. But we've tried very hard to make sure, you know, we do our job like we do with all taxpayers, which is we got a set of taxpayers with specific issues. We got a team together. We worked on these things. We did outreach and engagement, and we tried to really clarify what we could clarify.
If I had a question, what number would I call to get the answer?
You'd dial our 800 number.
And that number should get you to somebody who will give you the same answer day after day after day. You won't get two different answers.
That's our hope. We track accuracy and consistency, and they're always in the high 90s.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that. It's an issue I hear from the district a lot, and I want to know what it is that you have tried to do, and then we'll see if there's problems or we need to do something about it, we can look at it.
Thank you.
With your indulgence, Commissioner Shulman, Mr. Becerra has one follow-up question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for generously allowing me to ask one last question. Commissioner, 2 weeks ago I sat down with my tax preparer and went over my taxes in preparation to file. And he's been doing this forever. He's an enrolled agent. He's licensed and all the rest. And he said to me, you know, I was always supportive of what you all were doing with regard to the tax preparers and trying to get us to be a more defined group. So that way because he gets folks who come in to correct taxes that have been filed improperly by folks who prepared these things, charged people money and did it the wrong way. So he said, I thought I was always good. He asked me a question. He said, seems to me like a lot of us who have done this for a long time are the ones that are being asked to go through the process to certify that we're competent and all the rest. And I said to him, my sense is that everyone's going to be at some point touched by the IRS as it's moving towards the effort of trying to certify that folks are competent to be out there representing themselves as qualified preparers of tax returns for money. Chairman was gracious enough to indulge me, so I'm wondering if you can tell us what the status is of the initiative at the IRS to try to help do the bird dogging, the oversight of tax preparers, and maybe respond to the question of who's being contacted out in the tax preparer world by the IRS to follow up. He said he had to go through some courses or programs to test his qualifications and so forth. So if you can just give us a quick sense of where things stand.
Sure. First, similar to what I talked about with the real-time system, this is a big initiative. We had multiple public hearings around the country, vetted it with a report, put out regulations with lots of public comment, and so we've had a lot of engagement with the preparer community around this, because this is really about partnering with the preparer community to make sure taxpayers are served well. Status is we've had about 840,000 people apply and receive PTINs, which is a preparer taxpayer identification number. About 60% of those were not already an enrolled agent, a CPA, or a lawyer.
Wow.
Now, enrolled agents, your preparer, and CPAs and lawyers who already had higher level qualifications, had already gone through their own set of competency testing, already had ongoing continuing education requirements, were not requiring to take the test because they've already taken a test or have continuing education. And so your preparer should not have had to take a test if he was already an enrolled agent.
Right. And he didn't.
And so we have about 840,000 people who have signed up. Last fall, we started administering the competency examination, and we have a number of people through that. One of our promises was to the American people is we weren't going to cut out preparer services. We want to make sure people still could get service. And there's a lot of very competent preparers who have been preparing returns for 20, 30 years who haven't taken a test in a while. And so we gave them 3 years to pass the test. And so people are now starting to pass the test. You don't actually become a registered tax return preparer until you pass the test. So all you do is have a P-10 right now. So now people are starting to move through the test, and we've had several thousand who have taken the test, and we expect that number to grow. And we've started approving continuing education providers, because this year continuing education requirements kick in. And so we're well on our way to move there. The last thing I would say is this filing season, we're actually we had the P-10, we had CADE processing everything faster, and we've gotten a lot better at data analytics. And so we were able to look at preparers who had really egregious problems with their returns, go out them to them immediately in late January with visits, letters, phone calls, and really start to engage the preparer community to make sure they're treating taxpayers well. And so very pleased with the status of the initiative, and that's a broad overview.
Thanks very much. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Mr. Kine, you may inquire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, it was a little bit late. I was tied up in another meeting. Commissioner Shulman, thank you for your testimony and for the work that you're doing. We really appreciate it. Obviously, a lot of issues that are pending, but I had a chance to review the National Taxpayer Advocate Report, and I'm sure you all at the IRS too pay attention to that as well. But obviously, some of the disturbing trends that they see in that report is mainly the inadequacy of funding for the IRS in order to do your job adequately and serve the citizens of our country. And in particular, they were concerned about, because of funding cuts and the inadequacy of resources, what that means to the IRS ability to address the noncompliance issue. We've got a tax gap out there that everyone realizes. The concern is it's only going to grow wider. If there is a lack of confidence or belief in the IRS when it comes to compliance measures, it's only going to exacerbate the situation, I'm concerned. But do you agree with what the report was stating in regards to enforcement of noncompliance?
Well, look, we had budget cuts, and we try to do the best we can with those budget cuts. We talked for a while before about service, and we haven't really talked a lot about compliance. You know, clearly we're doing less exams this year, and we have to triage and find places. We're doing less collection activities, and it's going to result in less money coming in than otherwise would have come in. The big trend I'm worried about is if we don't stem the tide in the 2013 and 2014 budget, is you get to a point where there's enough news about compliance rates being so low that still a lot of people are going to pay their taxes because they're honest, hardworking Americans and they want to pay into the society that they feel benefits them. But if people want to push the envelope, which some do, and want to cut corners, if they think we're not on the job, then they'll do so. And so I think the general comments about you can't have a long-term trend of degrading compliance resources because that really starts to hit voluntary compliance is accurate. And I think the specific of just less funding means less dollars in the door. That's simple math.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions. We're approaching the second anniversary of passage of the Affordable Care Act. You know, one of the provisions then that allow tax credits to small businesses who do provide health care coverage for their workers, 35% this year. It's supposed to go to 50% in 2014 with the creation of the exchanges. There are moments back home when some small business owners come to me and complain about the complexity of that tax credit and having to fill that out. What's your opinion on that, and is that an item where the IRS or us working with you can try to simplify that process to make it easier for small businesses to qualify for that tax credit?
Yeah, I mean, one is it's obviously an important tax credit for small businesses to help them afford paying for health coverage for their workers, which is, you know, a key component of the Affordable Care Act. I think it's a very complex credit. We've heard from a lot of practitioners and small businesses that the phase-outs around that and other issues have made it very hard for people to, A, understand if they can hit the sweet spot where you get the credit, and, B, sometimes discourage people from actually taking advantage of the credit. The President's budget actually has a simplification proposal in it, which works on the phase-outs and other issues to make it hopefully much more attractive to small businesses. And Congress taking up and passing that, I think, would be beneficial. And I think,
do you think, you know, that makes a lot of sense, what the administration has looked at and what they're proposing to
yes.
do? Now, what about the in 2014, obviously, with the exchanges, there's going to be a lot of credits going for the individuals within the exchange market and that. Is the IRS making preparations in order to deal with that, and are you on track?
Yeah, so we are making preparations. We are on track. You know, the majority of the work we're doing and the people we've had to hire is to build technology systems to interact with the state exchanges and the federal exchange so that, you know, an estimated 30 million people can get over a 10-year period $400 billion of tax credits. I think I testified yesterday before our Appropriations Committee, and what I said to them is I understand that there's heartfelt policy debate about the Affordable Care Act and that there's some members of Congress who don't like it, there's members who like it, but the bottom line is come 2014, there's going to be a lot of constituents in every district who are going to expect a tax credit when they show up at the exchange, and we need to get funded appropriately in the 2013 budget to prepare for that. And so we're on track. We're spending money now based on authorization that came through the bill, but we're going to need to get financial support because we have a big job to do. Again, we're not involved in health policy. We're involved in moving the money to help make the law work.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know, this broader question of the complexity of the tax code should give impetus to all of us to look at fundamental tax reform. I know the chairman has set that as a goal, and I think it's something we should do in a bipartisan way. Commissioner Shulman, thank you for appearing before us today. As is customary, please be advised that members may have additional questions that they may submit to you in writing, and that those questions and your responses will be made part of the official record. And with that, we'll conclude the subcommittee hearing.